That's great. I'm really excited to be here. I'm so thankful for the invitation. I had no idea what I was getting into when I said yes. And to have talks bookended by music, like, this is a doctor's dream. This is so much nicer than speaking at most conferences. So let's see, we'll just go on here. So I'd like to talk to you a bit today about navigating pain. The first thing I want to introduce is this concept that pain is really an essential and primal signal within our bodies. If we don't feel pain, people who don't feel pain congenitally usually die early because they don't know when to move and shift and things. So this signal that we get from our body is really an essential warning system. The feeling of pain really maximizes your chance of survival. So as you can see on the slide, I have the picture of someone getting their leg bit by a dog. So if a dog bites you, you have to be able to very quickly localize where that is, figure out what's going on, see how painful that is. That signal that's coming up, it's really a danger signal. It's not pain till it hits the brain. The brain actually has to make sense of it. What does it mean? And then it changes your behavior so that you know, okay, I have to kick the dog in the head and run away. That's what it does. It makes you change behavior. And then it will teach you something. You learn that a dog coming up to you is dangerous and that it might bite you and that that's going to be painful and then you're going to have to do something. So it teaches you to activate your fight or flight, to change your behavior, and that you learn something from it. That's the whole purpose of pain, is to help you survive biologically. But what activates those neurons that are really just danger signals that your brain can interpret as pain or can change? All of you right now, I would assume, I don't think there's children in the audience right now, so I think all of you weigh at least 50 pounds, is that fair? Okay. So these neurons that carry danger information, we call them nociceptors, and they trigger at just 50 pounds of pressure. So all of you, all of your bums right now, are triggering this signal going up to your brain. But most of you, at least, won't have a lot of pain from your bum right now, because your brain's learned to interpret that signal as non-threatening. Whereas if a dog ran up and bit you in the bum right now, your brain would interpret that same 50 pounds of pressure as threatening, as painful. You see? So we have all this signal coming up. And how that signal is then altered and interpreted by the brain is super important. This slide advanced. No, it's not. Okay. So this is a very adaptive state, this very acute magnification of the acute pain signal is very adaptive for acute pain because it helps us survive. But it's not very adaptive for chronic pain. We evolved so that our system was highly, highly adapted for acute pain. If you had chronic pain, we got left behind in an ice floe or something ate us, you know? So our nervous system is really geared to magnify what's acute pain. But if the signal keeps going or if the nervous system gets sensitized and there's no more dog biting you and it's all healed, your nervous system can still send a signal, even sometimes with just pressure or just movement, can then trigger that response in the nervous system going up to your brain. So the brain can either dampen a signal or increase a signal. And the things that alter that are the memory that you have, so your hippocampus, the memory area of your brain, will play into how your brain views the signal, the meaning of the situation, how threatening it is to you, and also what other things are going on, like substance use, anxiety, other things that might magnify that signal. And so I'll give you an example of a case of a woman that I saw in our pain clinic. She had come, she was about 52 years old. She'd come from overseas. I don't want to give too many details because I don't want her ever to be identified. She's a lovely, lovely woman. But she'd had a fall at work, and she came in, and she had pain down her leg. It looked like sciatic pain. But her MRI had been good. She just had a little bit of a bulge. Maybe she'd irritated the nerve root a little bit. And we thought she'd heal up well in a multidisciplinary program. But about halfway through, nothing was moving. She just, you know, her pain experience was really heightened. It seemed like this biopsychosocial approach, there wasn't a lot of movement. So I brought her back in, and I asked her, you know, does this pain remind you of anything? And it turns out, something I totally missed on her intake, that she came from a country where at one point all of her and her fellow teachers had been rounded up because of political unrest in the country and taken, and she'd been put in solitary confinement for a year. And the method of torture that was given to her was an electrical cattle prod. And that feeling of having that electrical sensation down her leg after her fall was very similar to that feeling of the electrical cattle prod all the time. And so every time she had the sciatic pain, she had this reliving of this traumatic memory. And at that time, when she'd been taken and put away for a year, she didn't know if her family was alive or dead, or if they'd been taken too, or what had happened. So she had this profound sense of loneliness, as well as, because she was in solitary and taken out to be tortured, as well as this pain. And then when I dug a little deeper, it turns out just before her fall, a month before her fall, her husband had just died. And her adult children had long since left the home after they'd immigrated to Canada. So she was alone again in her home and she had this pain. So all of this was like colliding. So if we think we have an easy drug answer or an easy injection we're going to fix her with or anything, it's really a biopsychosocial thing, right? She was getting, her adult children had moved back into the home in order to help her. And so there was this what we call secondary gain, not a conscious thing, but her pain actually helped draw her children to her, as well as was, you know, kind of tumbling into the nightmare of her PTSD from before. So it's a very complex thing. So I'm just saying this to know that there's many, many layers to pain. Your past experience plays into pain. And also the healing of pain is multi-layered and multifactorial. So it's really a biopsychosocial spiritual approach. The other challenge that we have when we treat pain is that this alarm system that gets set off, your fight or flight, which again is very adaptive for acute pain, but in chronic pain, when there's no more dog biting your leg and you're just getting these signals, it's really maladaptive to have a lot of alarm go off. If you're playing football and you get smashed, it can be fun. But if you're being assaulted by someone, the same force cannot be so fun. So, and your alarm system will play differently in those different settings. It's on autopilot going forward. So one of the things we do in chronic pain is spend a lot of time helping people calm down that alarm system. So we need to help people understand it may hurt, but it may not harm you. You may not be doing tissue damage when you move, even though it may hurt to move. And so that you don't feel so threatened with the pain. And often, people can then manage pain better if you can tone down that alarm. And so the kinds of things we teach are mindfulness meditation, diaphragmatic breathing, yoga, all these other things have been shown to really impact people's pain experiences as much or more than medications. And how does that all play in? The baseline experience of what's happening to your nervous system really plays into how you can experience pain and how vulnerable you might be to develop a pain disorder later on. So for example, if you've had a history of binge intoxication with alcohol, also with opioids, or traumatic emotional events like the patient I just talked to you about, or previous injury like the patient I just talked to you about, all of this can change the set point you have for pain and the set point you have for anxiety. And there's genetic changes that go on in the nervous system that then can predispose you to, if exposed to alcohol or drugs, develop an alcohol or drug problem, or an anxiety or depression problem, or a pain disorder. All these pathways are interrelated and some of them overlap and some of them are actually the same targets in the brain. So what do we do about all that? It's a pretty complex system. So it's a balance between medication and non-medication, non-pharmacological options. And our goal in pain treatment is really we try to correct sleep disturbance, stabilize mood, eliminate unnecessary medications, and restore function. Often after pain has been in existence for about 6 months, people will have some degree of chronic pain for months or years to come, sometimes the rest of the life. And so how do we, because the nervous system is magnifying this and keeping it alive, to try to help you survive. So how do we intervene on that? There's been so many studies done on how to intervene on pain, and I'm just showing you the non-pharmacological ones on this slide. You can see that the vast majority are activity related. So exercise has been positive studies have come out in the field of exercise the most, more than even medications and interventions. Exercise has consistently been the thing that can help the most. Then chiropractic manipulation, acupuncture, multidisciplinary rehab, psychological therapies, massage, yoga, mindfulness, meditation, and Tai Chi. There's a number of different pharmacological strategies, medication strategies that we use in medicine that are also effective. And you can see on the screen there, the plus is areas that have been shown to be effective for certain kinds of pain. And across the upper bar, LBP is low back pain, OA is osteoarthritis, FM is fibromyalgia, and neuro just means neuropathic pain. So that's pain from nerve injury. And you can see the different medications on the screen there that have been shown, there's been some trials to show some effectiveness in those areas. When we talk about opioids, because they're on the screen, I just want to point out that now we do recommend that everybody who's on an opiate, either for medication for chronic non-cancer pain or due to an addictive disorder, that everyone have a take-home naloxone kit at home. And that's both for themselves, but also in case a friend or family member or grandchild or someone inadvertently got into your medication. We also recommend that you keep all of your medication, psychiatric medication or pain medication, locked in a safe that you have access to, but that you hide the key kind of thing. Just because also there can be strangers in your house or friends and you never know who's up to what. So just to keep yourself and your family safe. The other issue is that many of you know, because it's in the media a lot right now, that opioids can cause overdose. So that's the morphine family of drugs coming from the poppy plant, morphine, codeine, hydromorphone, oxycodone, all that whole family. But what many people don't know is there's also a dose-dependent ratio of inducing overdose, sleep apnea, which is trouble breathing at night, during sleep, testosterone suppression is dose-dependent, and myocardial infarction, heart attack, motor vehicle accidents, and addiction as well is dose-dependent. So what that means is that the higher the dose, the higher the risk of developing those things. It doesn't mean they have to ever happen, but it's just higher risk. And that's one of the reasons that your doctors may be working with you to try to get your doses down a bit. The other thing that many people don't know is that opiates themselves not only relieve pain, but they can actually cause pain. It's a phenomenon we call opiate-induced hyperalgesia or opiate-induced pain sensitivity. And I'll show you on the next slide. This is a slide that shows a peripheral nerve coming in, and then it's a cross-section of the spinal cord, and then nerves that go up to the brain, little image of brain there, and the nerves that come down from the brain onto the spinal cord. All of those areas can be affected by opiate medication. And strangely, they can redo your set point, so you actually get more pain sensitive. And there's research being done on all those areas. And that's why once you're tolerant to an opiate and you stop suddenly, you ache all over, because you're actually now more pain sensitive. You just don't know it because you keep taking an opiate usually. So it's only revealed when the opiate gets taken away. And so that's why we're trying to give fewer opioids often early in conditions and shorter doses so that people don't get tolerant. I also did some research looking at opiate withdrawal pain and found that some people get pain at old healed injury sites that were long healed before they started an opiate for a different reason. And it can hurt again during withdrawal. So it's like the memory of the pain comes back. And these are things we call central sensitization or peripheral sensitization. It's just ways that the nervous system can kind of hold the memory of an injury that can then get revealed during opiate withdrawal. So people think they still have an old injury or they still need to take their opiate because they hurt so much. So on top of chronic pain, they can have this added pain, and also at other injury sites they can hurt. So I had a fellow who got hit by a semi-trailer and pulled underneath, 16 breaks each side, his legs, both legs. And then when he healed, and he was pain-free and doing fine, but he had used heroin many years prior, so he relapsed to heroin use just from his addiction. And every time then, when he'd start to withdraw, he'd have the same pain as if he was crushed under the truck again. So he said it was like hot molten lava being poured over his legs, and he had to crawl on his hands and knees to the bathroom. But after about 3 weeks, when his withdrawal settled, it would take another week or two, and then his legs would be fine. He'd have no pain in them whatsoever. So this is the research I was doing. So these kind of things need to be known about. You know, often doctors don't tell you that these things can happen when they put you on an opiate medication. So really, people start their opiate treatment, their cellular changes, You get tolerance, which is the receptor gets resistant, but then you get all those other changes we just talked about, the opiate-induced hyperalgesia, OIH, that leads to what looks like tolerance. And so the doctors would just up your opioid. That's what I used to do. That's what I was trained at in med school. But now we know that this kind of gets you into a spiral and people end up on hundreds or thousands of milligrams sometimes. So is it a free ride? Okay, so maybe we should all switch to cannabis. Well, certainly there are some side effects to at least cannabis with THC in it. We now know that it's vasoconstrictive in the heart and in the brain. So anybody who's had cardiovascular disease or stroke shouldn't use any cannabis products with THC in it, is what the recommendations are now. And or anxiety or panic with THC. There's other forms of cannabinoids, and that's a whole other talk unto itself. But I just wanted to show you this latest study, which is the largest study of patients who have pain, who took cannabinoids. These were people on opiates already, and they followed people who took or didn't take cannabis, so marijuana. And they found that, unfortunately, it wasn't opiate sparing. All the companies want us to believe that it will help you get off opiates, but this study showed that that wasn't the case. And also that pain scoring and pain interference was worse if you were on a cannabinoid, which is opposite of what people were hoping for, right? So it's opposite of what they thought they were going to find. And also activity scoring, how people could get up and move and do stuff, was actually lower on cannabis. And so there ultimately was, in this study, no evidence that cannabis improved outcome. And it's the largest cannabis study we have. Most cannabis studies are like 25 to 50 people. And this one was 1,514 people. It's the biggest study we have to date, followed for 4 years, Australian study. Just came out this summer. So we have to be a bit more cautious than what we were initially thinking. So really, what is it that we're trying to aim at? We really need a biopsychosocial spiritual approach to treatment in order to hit that sweet spot of sustained recovery. Often we don't try to have complete elimination of pain. It's great if we, oh, that's not me. but it will be Patrick soon. So we really want a balance of pharmacological and non-pharmacological therapies and try to calm down that alarm system, try to be really judicious with our medications. And our bodies are wired to teach us not to move because it hurts. So we have to overcome that acute biology in order to fight chronic pain. We have to do what is opposite of how we're biologically wired. Because we have to, if we just lay on the couch, I'm not saying that anybody here just lays on the couch, because you're all here. But if we just, every time pain hurts, if we back off, then what we do is we end up caging ourselves. But what we have to do is actually move through that and beyond and activate, because it's keeping active and exercising and such, and judicious use of medication and non-medication options that's going to help give us that functional benefit that we're seeking. Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to introduce Patrick now.